sleep by day and don't strike a light, Ruby said. Reckon even if you don't run all the way, you'll be there for Christmas. They say you know Georgia when you come to it, for it's nothing but red dirt and rough roads. Ruby dismissed him from her attention and turned to Ada and started planning their journey. The timing worked out poorly. It was Ruby's reasoning that with the days approaching the shortest of the year, one way or the other, either going or coming, they'd spend a night in the woods. It did not much matter which, was her thinking. They might as well get on. So she and Ada left the boy mopping his plate with a heel of cornbread and went in the house and banked up the fire and quickly threw together a camping kit to Ruby's specification. Bedding, cookware, food, candles, a tin box of lucifer matches, and the sandpaper needed to ignite them, a dry bundle of fatwood kindling, a coil of rope, a hand axe, shotgun with powder and shot and wadding, grain for the horse, a mattock and spade. They heaped the gear in paired hemp sacks and tied the necks together and threw them over Ralph's neck like rude, lumpish panniers. Ruby looked about at the sky for any marks of cloud or air or light that might foreshow the weather, and what they told was snow and gathering cold. She said, "Have you got any breeches in the house?"
"Trousers," Ada said.
"Woolen or canvas, either one, two pair."
"Of my father's, yes," Ada said.
"We need to go put them on," Ruby said.
"Men's trousers," Ada said.
"You wear what you want," Ruby said, "but I don't relish the feel of a winter wind blowing up my dress tail, and who's up there to see?" They found pairs of heavy wool hunting trousers, one pair black and the other gray. They dressed in long underwear, and then drew the trousers on, and cuffed up the bottoms and cinched the waists in with belts, so that the extra material gathered like big pleats. They put on wool shirts and sweaters, and Ruby noted Monroe's broad-brimmed hats and said they would keep the snow from their faces, so they took two down from the shelf and put them on as well. Had the circumstances been happier, Ada thought, this would have been like the hair contest, a game of dress-up, against which they might wager to see who could accouter herself more convincingly as a man, take lamp soot and draw mustaches and burn sides on their faces, carry around unlit cigars, and mimic the silly gestures men used in smoking them. Instead, they hardly spoke as they dressed, and they both were filled with dread toward the next pair of days. Before they left, they rubbed beeswax into their boots, and opened the door to the hen house, and likewise the door to the cow's stall, and they heaped down hay on the floor. Ruby reckoned Waldo would be bawling to have her bag stripped by the time they got back. They gave the boy food and bedding and told him to sleep in the hayloft until dark made it safe for him to travel. When they went off leading the horse, the boy still sat between the boxwoods, and he waved to them like a host bidding visitors farewell. Toward evening, snow fell through fog in the woods. Ada and Ruby walked in dim light under fir trees, and they were but vague dark shapes moving through a place that lacked all color other than gradations of gloom. The nearest trees looked very much like genuine trees, but those only slightly farther away were but a suggestion of trees, as in a quick sketch, a casual gesture toward the form of trees. All of it seemed to Ada as if there were no such thing as landscape, and that she wandered along in a cloud, with what little she could know an arm's length away. All else shrouded from understanding. It made Ralph nervous, and the horse went bowing his neck to left and right, and working his ears back and forth to catch sounds of threat. They had climbed for a long time under the thick canopy of dark hemlocks. Then they crossed a low ridge and descended into a creek valley. They had long since left what to Ada was familiar territory. The footing was soft from layers of dropped needles, and snow fell through the treetops as dry as sifted meal, and swirled about the ground in patterns of arcs and loops. It seemed not to want to lie down. After a time they crossed a black creek, stepping with care on the dry backs of humped stones. Ada looked at the way the creek was seizing up with a thin rim of bright ice along its banks, and around rocks and fallen trees and nubbles of moss, anything that hindered the flow. In the center of the creek, though, the fast water ripped along as always. Where it ran shallower and slower, then, were the places prone to freezing. Monroe would have made a lesson of such a thing, Ada thought. He would have said what the match of that creek's parts would be in a person's life, what God intended it to be the type of. All God's works but elaborate analogy, every bright image in the visible world only a shadow of a divine thing, so that earth and heaven, low and high,
strangely agreed in form and meaning, because they were in fact congruent. Monroe had a book wherein you could look up the types. The rose, its thorns, and its blossom, a type of the difficult and dangerous path to spiritual awakening. The baby, come wailing to the world in pain and blood, a type of our miserable earthly lives, so consumed with violence. The crow, its blackness, its outlaw nature, its tendency to feast on carrion, a type of the dark forces that wait to overtake man's soul. So Ada quite naturally thought the stream and the ice might offer a weapon of the spirit, or perhaps a warning, but she refused to believe that a book could say just how it should be construed or to what use it might be put. Whatever a book said would lack something essential and be as useless by itself as the gudgeon to a door hinge with no pennel. On the stream's far bank, the horse stopped and shook its hide until the pots rattled in their sacks. And then he stretched out his neck and breathed soft and long out into the world, in hope of some assuring companion breath in return. Ada cupped her hand to his velvet muzzle. He put his tongue out, and she took it between thumb and forefinger, and waggled it gently, and then they went on. For a time they kept to the creek side as it tumbled from the mountain, but then the trail turned up a faint branch and entered a forest of hardwoods, where there were yet twisted scraps of leaves clinging to the oak trees. They were old, tired oaks, and had globes of mistletoe in their branches. Snow fell harder, and began to stick to the ground, and the trail became a faint, sunken line through the woods, an easy thing to miss as night came on. What path there was held not even the cup tracks of hogs. It seemed some abandoned Indian trail, long unwalked, linking a set of points that no longer existed. They walked on well past nightfall, the snow still coming down. The clouds were thick and hid the waxing moon. Nevertheless, there was light in the snow where it stood gathered up under the black tree trunks. Shelter was Ada's first thought, and at every rock ledge she said, "There's a place we could sleep." But Ruby said she knew a better place, or at least thought she remembered a place nearby, and they walked on. In time they came to a tumble of great flat rocks. Ruby cast about until she found what she was looking for, three that had fallen upon each other so as to form a lean-to, a sort of accidental dolmen with flat, straight walls, a capstone fitted tight and angled back so as to shed water, leaving underneath a room no bigger than a cock loft, but enough to sit up and shift around in. As architecture, its shape reminded Ada of the symbol for pi. Inside, the floor was thick with dry leaves. Spring water rose from the ground not 20 yards away, all set around with chestnut and oak trees that had never been cut since the day of creation. It made as fine a camp as anyone could ever expect to find, and Ruby said that though she had not visited the place in years, it was exactly as she remembered, from having spent many a night there as a child out foraging for food. Ruby put Ada to gathering armloads of the dry limbs she could find, and within half an hour they had a warm blaze going at the mouth of the shelter, a pot of water boiling for tea. When it was done steeping, they sat and drank it, ate a few dried biscuits and some dried apples. The rings were from apples so small as to be little more than a bite apiece, but their sharp taste bound together all the best features of the past warm season. They did not talk much while they ate, other than for Ada to say that the Georgia boy did not seem like much of a one as far as men went. Ruby said she found him not particularly worse than the general order of men, which is to say that he would greatly benefit from having someone's foot in his back every waking minute. When they were done eating, Ruby brushed away the leaves of the shelter floor with the heel of her hand, and scooped out dirt and sifted it through her fingers, and held out a palm to the firelight for Ada to see. Fragments of charcoal and splinters of flint, ancient fire and partial arrow points, flawed and discarded, flakes of old hope, however slight. Neither of them said anything, but Ada picked through the flint splinters and kept the point nearest completion, and found comfort that people in some dim other time had done as they were doing, had found shelter in this rock pile and eaten a meal and slept. The snow hissed as it fell, and the temperature was dropping fast, but the fire soon heated the stones, and when Ada and Ruby wrapped themselves in blankets and burrowed in among the dry leaves and heaped more leaves atop the quilts, they were warm as lying in a bed at home. This would do, Ada thought, as she lay there. The abandoned trail through mountains and rivers, not a soul around. The stone shelter warm and dry and strange as an elfin lodge. Though others might view it as an utterly bare haven, It matched her needs so much that she could just move in and live there. The fire threw patterns of light and shadow on the pitched roofstone, and Ada found that if she watched long enough, the fire would form the shapes of things in the world. A bird, a bear, a snake, a fox, or perhaps it was a wolf. The fire seemed to have no interests other than animals. The pictures put Ada in mind of a song, one of Stavrod's. It had particularly stuck in her mind. She had noted it for the oddity of its lyric and for Stavrod's singing, which had been of an intensity that Ada could only assume represented deep personal expression. It took as subject the imagined behavior of its speaker, what he would do had he the power to become one of a variety of brute creature, a lizard in the spring, hear his darling sing, a bird with wings to fly, go back to his darling, weep and moan till he dies, a mole in the ground, root a mountain down. Ada worried over the song. The animals seemed wonderful and horrible in their desires, especially the mole, a little powerless hermit blind thing, propelled by lonesomeness and resentment to bring the world falling around him. More wonderful and horrible still was the human voice speaking the song's words, wishing away its humanity to ease the pain inflicted by lost love, love betrayed, love left unexpressed, wasted love. Ada could hear in Ruby's breathing that she was yet awake, and so she said, "Do you remember that song of your father's about the mole in the ground?" Ruby said that she did, and Ada asked if Ruby thought Stavrod had written the song. Ruby said there were many songs that you could not say anybody in particular made by himself. A song went around from fiddler to fiddler, and each one added something and took something away, so that in time the song became a different thing from what it had been, barely recognizable in either tune or lyric. But you could not say the song had been improved, for as was true of all human effort, there was never advancement. Everything added meant something lost, and about as often as not, the thing lost was preferable to the thing gained, so that over time we'd be lucky if we just broke even. Any thought otherwise was empty pride. Ada lay and watched the fire shadows and listened to the sound of snow in the leaves, and soon drifted off, and slept a dreamless sleep, not even waking when Ruby rose to toss more wood on the fire. When Ada awoke, it was first light, and she could see that the snow had slackened in its falling, but had not stopped. It lay ankle-bone deep on the ground. Neither Ruby nor Ada was eager to get on with the day that stretched before them. They sat with the blankets around their shoulders, and Ruby blew up the coals and stoked the fire. She fried a piece of side meat and forked it out of its grease and put it on a flat rock. Then she added water to the grease and cooked a pot of grits and took the side meat from the rock and crumbled it into the pot and stirred it into the grits. In the smaller pot, Ada made tea. And as they sipped, Ruby told how when she first had tea, supplied by Mrs. Swanger, she had admired it so much that she gave Stavrod a handful of it, tied in a square of cloth as he went off on a coon hunt. The next time she saw him, some weeks later, she had asked him how he liked it. Stavrod had said it was no better than fair, and that he didn't find it preferable to any other kind of greens. Ruby came to find out he had cooked it up with a strip of fatback and eaten it like cresses. When they reached the trail fork, they found the Pangle Boy lying alone, face up beneath the poplar. He was covered with a mantle of snow. It lay slumped over him, thinner than on the ground nearby, and it was clear how the snow had first melted about him and then had not. Ruby brushed away the snow to look at his face, and when she did, she found him still smiling, though with a look of confusion in his eyes, which might have been just the look of death. Ruby cupped her hand to his fat cheek and then touched him with her fingertips on his brow, as if to stamp him with the badge of a like outcast. Ada turned from him and began kicking at the snow with her boot toe. And when she did, she turned up pieces of broken banjo, then the broken fiddlestick, the frog piece dangling from horsehair. She kicked around more, looking for the fiddle, but she did not find it. No fiddle and no Stavrod. "Where is he?" Ada said. "There's not anybody from Georgia can tell more than half the truth," Ruby said. "Dead or alive, they took him with them." They decided to bury Pangle on a little shelf of land up above the trail near a chestnut tree. The ground dug easily, and they hardly needed the mattock, for only a thin rind of ground was frozen, and under that the topsoil was black and loose and went down and down. They took turns with the shovel, and soon they were hot in their coats, and they took them off and hung them on tree limbs. Then they were too cold, but it was better to be cold than to wet your clothes with sweat. By the time they started hitting significant rocks, they had quite a hole, though it was still 2 feet shallower than the 6 which Ada thought to be the rule of graves. But it would do, Ruby said. They went to Pangle, and each took a leg, and dragged him through the snow to the grave, and slid him in. They had no box, not even a spare blanket to shroud him with, so Ada spread her kerchief over his face before they began shoveling the dirt. By the time they had covered him to where only one boot toe was left showing, Ada was weeping, though she had seen the boy but once in life, and that by firelight, and all the words that had passed between them had been him saying Stobrod's playing had done her good. Ada remembered her thoughts when they had buried winter cabbages, how she had made it metaphoric, but she found this burial to be an entirely different matter. Beyond the bare fact of holes in the ground, there was no similarity at all between the two. When they had filled the grave above level, they had more dirt left, which Ruby noted and attributed to the time of the month, the growing of the moon toward full. Dig a grave a week into the wane and you'd have a swale when you were done. They mounded the moon's extra dirt over Pangle and packed it with the back of the spade. Then Ada took her clasp knife and stripped bark from a hickory sapling and sought out a black locust and lopped two of its limbs with a hand axe and lashed them together with the hickory withes to form up a cross. She stood it in the soft ground at Pangle's head, and though she did not say words aloud over him, she made some in her mind. She'd heard Ruby say locust had such will to live that you could split fence posts from the wood of its trunk, and they'd sometimes take root in the post holes and grow. Such was Ada's hope for her own construction, that some day a tall locust would stand to mark Pangle's place, and that every year into the next century it would tell, in brief, a tale like Persephone's, black bark in winter, white blossoms in spring. Their hands were dirty. Ruby just cupped up snow and rubbed it between her palms and shook off the dirty water. But Ada went through the woods to the creek and knelt and washed her hands and then dashed icy water in her face. She stood and shook her head and looked about. Her eyes fell on a low rock ledge beyond the creek. It made an overhang, a shelter. The brown of the dirt stood out dark against the snow. Under the rock lip sat Stobrod, though it took a minute for Ada to make him out, since his clothes matched up with the dark of the exposed earth. He was still, eyes closed, and he sat with his legs crossed, his head to the side, and his hands composed around the fiddle in his lap. A little wind rose up and rattled a few oak leaves and shook snow from bare limbs. It fell in Ada's hair and onto the creek face, where it melted as it struck. "Ruby," Ada called, "Ruby, I need you here." They stood over him, and his face was the hue of the snow, and he looked so meager in his parts, such a little man. He had lost a great deal of blood through the wounds, and had spit up yet more, and he was stained all down his shirt front. Ruby took the fiddle from his lap and handed it to Ada, and the snake rattle shifted dryly inside it. When Ruby undid his buttons, the blood in his shirt was black and stiff. His chest was frail and white. Ruby put her ear to it and pulled away and then listened again. "He's yet living," she said. She pulled apart his clothes and turned him about to survey the damage and found he'd been hit 3 times. Through his bow hand, where he held it before him, through the meat of his ham nigh to the hip bone, and, the most serious, through the nipple to his chest. That ball had broken a rib and scored the top of his lungs and lodged in his back muscles above the shoulder blade. There was a blue lump under his skin the size of a crab apple. In the moving of him, he did not break consciousness or even moan in pain. Ruby drew together kindling and whittled off shavings from a pine branch and struck fire from the matches. When the fire was going, she held the blade of the homemade knife in the flames. She cut into Stobrod's back, and he still made no sound nor fluttered his eyes. There was just a bare rindle of blood from the cut, as if he had not enough left for the new wound to do more than sweat a few red drops. Ruby put her finger into his back and inquired around with it, and then she hooked the ball out. She reached and put it into Ada's hand, and it was like a gobbet of raw meat. "Go rinse that off," Ruby said. "He'll want it some day." Ada went to the creek and held her hand in the water and let the current run through her caged fingers. When she drew it out and looked at it, the lead was clean and gray. In passing through Stobrod, it had been pressed into a shape like a mushroom, the cap fluted and split and misgrown. The stem end, though, was intact, cut with 3 precise rings during its manufacture to take best advantage of a barrel's rifling. Ada went back to the ledge and set the bullet beside the fiddle. Ruby had Starbrod wrapped in blankets, and the fire was burning knee-high.
"You stay and boil me some water," Ruby said to Ada. Ada watched her wander off through the woods, the shovel over her shoulder and her head down, looking for healing roots, which she could know only from their dried stalks and husks poking up from the snow. Ada arranged stones around the fire for pot rest, and went to the horse and got a pot from the sacks. She dipped it full of creek water and put it on the stones to heat. She sat and looked at Starbrod, and he lay like a dead man. There was no sign to show he lived, other than a slight movement of his jacket front when he breathed. Ada wondered about his hundreds of tunes. Where were they now, and where might they go if he died? When Ruby returned an hour later, she had her pockets full of any root she could find that might be remotely useful. Mullein, yarra, burdock, ginseng. But she had not found golden seal, which was the thing she needed most. The herb had been scarce of late, hard to find. She worried that people were proving themselves not worthy of healing, and that golden seal had departed in disgust. She packed a mash of mullein and yarra root and burdock into Starbrod's wounds, and bound them with strips cut from a blanket. She brewed tea from the mullein and ginseng, and dripped it into his mouth, but his throat seemed clenched shut, and she could not tell if any went down or not. After a while she said, "It's too far home. He'll not make it there alive. It might be days before he can travel, and I'd not be surprised if there was more snow coming. We need better shelter than this." "Back to the rock ledge," Ada said. "We wouldn't all fit," Ruby said, "not and have room to cook and work over him. There's a place I know, if it's there yet." They left Starbrod where he lay while they cut long poles to make shafts for a drag sledge. They tied the poles together with rope and lashed more across for web sling and harnessed the rig to the horse. They carried Starbrod across the creek in the blankets and put him on, but when they headed up the left trail fork with him dragging behind the horse and bumping on every rock and root, they could see that their thoughts had been wrong and that the jarring would tear him apart at his wounds. So they pulled the sledge to pieces, coiled the rope, and draped Starbrod over the horse and went on slowly. The sky was flat and gray, and it hovered over their heads so close it seemed they could reach up and touch it. For a brief while, snow again emerged out of it, blown on a cutting wind. First it came in great flakes like goose down, then faint and dry as ashes. When the snow stopped, fog welled up, thick around them, and the only thing clear was that the day was falling away. They walked for some time without speaking, except when Ruby would say, "Here," and they would turn at a fork. Ada did not know which way they went, for she had long since lost certainty of the cardinal points. When they stopped to rest, the horse stood head down, tired and miserable, exhausted from the load he was carrying and the altitude. Ada and Ruby brushed the snow off a log and sat. They could not see a thing in the fog but the nearest trees. The feel of the air, though, suggested that they were on a ridge, and that there was much open air and gravity around them. Ada huddled inside her coat, trying not to think of going through another day of this, or of where they might spend the night, just the next mile. Starbrod lay draped over the horse exactly where Ada and Ruby had placed him. While they sat, two peregrines came bursting out of the fog. They flew into the shifting wind, their wings making short, choppy strokes for purchase against the difficult air. They flared so close that Ada could hear the hiss of wind through the feathers. Starbrod awoke and raised his head momentarily as the birds passed, and then he stared after them vaguely as they faded back in the fog. A line of blood ran to his chin from his mouth corner, thin as a razor cut. "Pigeon hawk," he said, as if putting a name to the birds might help him regain his footing. He started struggling, and it seemed he wanted to square himself on the horse to ride, and so Ruby helped him, but when she let go he fell forward until his head rested on the withers. His eyes were closed, and his arms stretched past his head to grip the mane with both hands. His leg swung limp below Ralph's round belly. Ruby wiped his mouth with her coat sleeve, and they went on. For most of an hour they descended a steep hillside, and then Ada thought they were cupped in a valley, though she could not see far enough in any direction to verify the feeling. They crossed a marshy place, and on either side of the trail huckleberry bushes grew head high. At the bottom of the valley they passed a pool of still black water. It came up out of the fog as if a hole had opened in the world. Old dead ribbons of taupe bunch grass ringed it, and ice scalloped all around its verge like a camera iris closing. Three black ducks floated motionless in the pool's center, their heads tucked against their breasts.
Were she writing a book of types, Ada thought, that would do for fear. The fog was thinning some. They climbed again, just a low ridge with hemlocks growing on its spine, and many were blown down with their root plates standing revealed in the air like a dissection. They descended through the trees and into a stand of chestnuts. They were moving toward a stream which they could hear but not see. It was rough walking. There was not really a trail at all, just enough space between the trees and the ragged brush and low scrub to make a way for passage. When they came off the ridge toward a pinched creek bottom, the light had not changed, though the day felt all but spent. Ada began to make out rectangular shapes through the trees. Huts. Cabins. A tiny Cherokee village, a ghost town, its people long since driven out onto the Trail of Tears and banished to a barren land. Except for one rotted relic from the age of Wattle and Daub, the cabins were made of chestnut logs, peeled and notched and lapped, roofed with shingles and curls of chestnut bark. A big white oak had fallen across one hut, but the rest were largely intact after 3 decades alone, and such was the power of chestnut timber against damp that they might remain so for 100 years more before melting into the ground. Gray lichen grew on the cabin logs, and dried stalks of horseweed and pigweed and fleabane rose from the snow in the doorways. There was not flat ground for raising much in the way of crops, so it might have been a seasonal hunting camp, or refuge wherein a handful of carnivore outcasts had lived, nearly anchoritic. All in all, only a half dozen little windowless cells. They were set at uneven intervals down the bank of the creek, which was deep and strong and black, its way broken by great smooth boulders with green moss grown on their faces. In Ada's fatigue, she thought it a matter of great importance to know, without asking, on which bank of the creek the cabin stood, north, south, east, west. It would go a way toward ordering her mind congruent with where she was. Ruby always seemed to know the compass points, and to find them significant, not just when giving directions, but even in telling a story and indicating where an event had happened. West bank of the Little East Fork, east bank of the West Fork, that sort of thing. What was required to speak that language was a picture held in the mind of the land one occupied. Ada knew the ridges and coves and drainages were the frame of it, the skeleton. You learned them and where they stood in relation to each other, and then you filled in the details working from those known marks, general to particular. Everything had a name. To live fully in a place all your life, you kept aiming smaller and smaller in attention to detail. Ada had only just begun to form such a picture, and she looked to the sky for help in finding direction, but it offered none, for the sky lay so close it seemed she might hit her head on it, and there were no other hints to follow. In this lush climate, moss grew on whatever side of a tree it cared to. North meant nothing to moss here. So Ada knew only that, as far as she was concerned, the village could stand on any bank of the creek whatsoever. No direction could be ruled out. The cabins they passed among seemed solemn in their abandonment, cramped by the watercourse and the overhanging brow of the cloudy mountain. Some of its people might yet be living, and Ada wondered how often they remembered this lonesome place, now still as a held breath. Whatever word they had called it would soon be numbered among the names of things which have not been passed down to us and are exiled from our memories. She doubted that its people, even in the last days, had ever looked ahead and imagined loss so total and so soon. They had not foreseen a near time when theirs would be another world, filled with other people whose mouths would speak other words, whose sleep would be eased or troubled with other dreams, whose prayers would be offered up to other gods. Ruby picked the best of the cabins, and they stopped before it. They took Stobrod off the horse and made him a nest on the ground with the tarpaulin and blankets, and then they went into the hut's one windowless room. The door was made of hewn planks and had swung on leather hinges, long since broken. It lay on the floor. All that could be done to close it was to prop it in its hole. The packed dirt floor was littered with blown leaves, and they swept it with a pine bough. There was a dry stone hearth, a mud-and-stick chimney. Ruby put her head in and looked up and saw daylight, but it had apparently never drawn well, and the chestnut log roof beams were dark and shiny with years of accumulated smoke. Beneath the odor of dust, the house was still infused with the rich smell of 1,000 old campfires. There was a wooden sleeping platform along one wall, a layer of gray straw still on it. They carried Stobrod in and rested him there. While Ruby built up a fire in the hearth, Ada went out and cut a long straight limb and trimmed it sharp with the hatchet and hammered it into the ground and staked out the horse under a cedar. But he was wet and shivering. He stood with his head down, and his winter coat was pressed in dark curls to his skin from snow melt. Ada looked at him and at the sky and judged the cold by the sting of her cheeks. Ralph might be dead on the ground by morning. She loosed him from the stake and tried to lead him into one of the huts, but he did not want to duck his head to go through the door. She pulled at the lead rope, and he lowered his hind end and backed away, pulling her until she fell forward into the snow. She got up and found a stick as big around as her wrist, and she got behind the horse and hit him again and again with all the strength she had left in her, which was not an awful lot. Finally, he plunged into that black door hole as if into death. Once inside, though, Ralph was immediately content, for the hut hardly differed in dimensions or materials from a barn stall. Within minutes he had relaxed. He shook out his hide and spraddled his legs and pissed a long and satisfying piss. Ada fed him grain out of the cook pot and then took the pot and rinsed it in the creek. It was almost dark, and Ada stood and looked at the final sheen of light on the water. She was tired and cold and scared. This seemed like the lonesomest place on earth. She dreaded night and the moment when the campcraft was all done, and she would have to wrap herself in a blanket and lie in the dark on the cold dirt floor of the ghost cabin to wait for morning. She was so tired her legs felt burnt out from under her, but she believed she could get through this if she did one thing at a time, and thought of the remaining things left to be done as sequential, not cumulative. She went inside and found that Ruby had cooked a supper like to their breakfast. But when Ada put the first spoon of the greasy grits to her mouth, they would not go down. Her stomach knotted up. She stood and went out and vomited in the snow, though about all she had left in her to bring up was black bile. Then she rubbed her mouth with snow and went inside and ate again until her bowl was empty. She sat with it in her lap, exhausted, in stunned silence before the hearth. She had forgotten to drink water for most of the day. That and the cold, the walking, and the work of burying and healing had turned her mind strange, so that her only wish was to seek happier visions in the fire coals. She looked and looked, but found none, in either the liquid shapes of flame or the geometric scorings charred in the sides of the fire logs. But the burning wood made squeaking sounds, like footsteps tramping in dry snow, and even Ada knew what that betokened, more ready to fall. Footsteps in the Snow. When he reached the place where three ways came together, there was barely enough light left behind the western clouds for Inman to study signs on the ground for the story they told. The snow was marked by tracks coming up to the flat ground at the fork, and then going on, up the rising left-hand trail. There was black blood on the ground beneath a big poplar where killing had been done. The snow all about was churned up by the walking of people and horses. There had been a recent fire in a ring of stones beyond the poplar, and the ashes were cold, but still held the smell of pork fat. Footsteps and a drag trail led to a cross of sticks standing at the head of a raw dig. Inman squatted and looked at it, thinking this: if there is a world beyond the grave, as hymns claim, such a hole makes a grim, lonesome portal to it. He was somewhat puzzled. There ought to have been two burials, and though Inman had seen men laid one atop another to save shovel work, he reckoned that was not the case here. He rose and went back to studying the signs, and he followed them across the creek to the rock ledge, and there under he found more blood on the ground, and the still warm coals of a little fire, a pile of sodden roots where they'd been cast on the ground with their cooking water. He picked up pieces of root and rubbed them in his hand and smelled them, and he could tell ginseng and mullein. He set them on a rock and went to the creek and dipped up a handful of water to drink. A salamander, wildly spotted in colors and patterns unique to that one creek, moved among the stones. Inman lifted it out and held it cupped in his hand and looked at the salamander's face. The way its mouth curved around its head shaped a smile of such great serenity as to cause Inman envy and distress. Living hid under a creek rock would be about the only way to achieve such countenance, Inman thought. He returned the salamander to its place and walked back and stood in the crotch of the trail and looked off where the tracks led. He could see hardly 10 feet ahead before they faded in the dark that was settling fast. He figured Ada might recede before him forever, and leave him a lone pilgrim going on and on. The clouds hung low and thick. There would be no moon, and the night would soon be black as the inside of a cold stove. He put back his head and sniffed the air, and it smelled like snow. It was a matter of which was worse, to lose the track in the night or to have it covered over. Of the two, the dark was certain and nigh, and so Inman went back to the ledge and sat and watched the last light fall away. He listened to the creek and tried to make up a story to fit the signs, one that would explain the single grave, and why the two women had gone on across the mountain instead of following their own tracks home. But it was hard to reason things out in the state he was in. Part from choice and part from necessity, Inman was fasting, and his senses would not row up properly. He had not eaten bite one in the days since he had cooked the bear cub. The creek had the sound of voices in the rush of its water and the clicking of its bedstones against one another, and he thought they might tell him what had taken place there if he listened hard enough. But the voices shifted and blurred, and the words had no meaning to him, try as he might to make them out. Then he reckoned he was not hearing voices at all, just words forming up in his head, and even then he could not make sense of them. He was too empty for sense. His sacks held no food but for a few walnuts he had picked up off the ground 2 days previous at a place where a cabin had burned. There was nothing left of it but a cone of sooty dirt where the clay chimney had stood, and a good-sized walnut tree beyond where the front of the house would have been. There had been yet walnuts on the ground under it. The black shells lay inside little nests in the grass, where the grass had grown long around the husks, and the husks had rotted away. Inman had put what nuts he could find in his haversack, but had never got around to eating them, for the more he thought, the more he reckoned that the work it would take to break them open would overbalance the sustenance he would get from them, each one holding no more meat than would be around the end joint of your forefinger. Yet he didn't throw them out, for he worried that if you put all life to such a test, it would not seem worth living. And, too, he found the sound of them comforting as he walked. They rattled against each other with the dry talk of old bones hanging in trees. He looked at the bitter roots on the rock where he had laid them. He first thought to nibble at them, but then he picked them up and threw them into the creek. He took a walnut out of his sack and threw it into the creek, too, and it made the valved sound of a scared frog plunging in water. He left the other nuts in his sack, though he intended to eat nothing until he found Ada. If she would not have him, he would go on to the heights and see if the portals at the Shining Rocks would open to him, as the woman with the snake tattoos had suggested they would to one with a fasting heart, empty in all his faculties. Inman could think of no reason to hold back. He doubted there was a man in the world emptier than he at that moment. He would walk right out of this world and keep on going into that happy valley she had described. Inman broke up limbs and kindled a strong fire on the coals of the earlier fire. He rolled two large stones into it to heat. For a long time he lay wrapped in his blankets, with his feet to the fire, and thought about that pair of tracks leading away. When he had started the day, he had not thought that by dark he would be lying on the cold ground again. Once home, he assumed he would differ from his recent self in every regard, in his design of living, his views on life, and even in the way he walked and stood. And that morning he had thought, certainly by nightfall, to have declared himself to Ada, and to have gotten some response, yea, nay, or maybe. He had played out the scene in his mind many days as he walked, and as he lay waiting for sleep in every bear camp along the way. He would come walking up the road into Black Cove, and he would be weary-looking. What he had been through would show in his face and in his frame, but only so much as to suggest heroism. He would be bathed and in a clean suit. Ada would step out the door onto the porch without knowing he was coming, just going about her doings. She would be dressed in her fine clothes. She would see him and know him in every feature. She would run to him, lifting her skirts above her ankle boots as she came down the steps. She would rush across the yard and through the gate in a flurry of petticoats, and before the gate had even clapped shut, they would be holding each other in the roadway. He had seen it in his mind over and over until it came to seem that there was no other way it could happen except that he be killed getting home. Such an imagined scene of homecoming had been the hope in his heart when he had come walking up the Black Cove Road before noon. He had done his part to make it so, for he arrived weary but clean, having on the day previous, aware that he looked rougher than the lowest muleteer, stopped at a creek to bathe and to wash his clothes. It had been chill weather for such work, but he built a fire of dry logs until the flames stood shoulder high. He heated pot after pot of water, almost to boiling, and unfolded his soap from its brown paper wrapping, dark and greasy from the tallow. He poured the water on the clothes and rubbed them with the soap and twisted them and battled them on stones and then rinsed them in the creek. He had spread the clothes on bushes near the fire to dry, and then he started in on himself. The soap was brown and gritty and had a great deal of lye in it, so that it would about take off hide. He had washed himself with water as hot as he could stand and scrubbed with the soap until his skin felt raw. Then he touched his face and hair. He had just about raised a new beard since shaving at the girl's cabin, and his hair was half wild about his head. He had no razor, and so the beard would have to stand, and he reckoned himself a poor barber, even had he scissors and a glass. With nothing but a sheath knife and a still pool at the creek edge, he could not expect to improve his haircut any. The best he could do was to heat more water, soap and rinse his hair, comb it out with his fingers, and try to shape it to his head so that it would not stand up and look alarming. When he had finished washing, he sat through the remainder of the chill day, squatting naked but clean under his blankets. He slept naked, wrapped in his blankets, while his clothes dried over the fire. Where he had camped, the snow but came spitting out of the sky a while and then stopped. When he dressed in the morning, the clothes at least smelled of lye soap and creek water and chestnut smoke rather than sweat. He had then made his way to Black Cove over trails, taking care not to strike the road until he was but a bend or two below the house. When he came to it, there was smoke from the chimney, but no other sign of life. The little snow in the yard lay unmarked. He opened the gate and went to the door and knocked. No one came, and he knocked again. He went around back, where he found the tracks of a man's boots in the snow between the house and the privy. A frozen nightgown hung stiff from the clothesline. Chickens in the henhouse fluttered and clucked, and then settled down. He went to the back door and knocked hard, and in a minute an upstairs window flew open, and a black-haired boy stuck his head out and asked who the hell he was and what the hell he meant making such a racket. In time, Inman got the Georgia boy to come to the door and let him in. They sat by the fire, and Inman heard the tale of the killings. The boy had worked over the story in his mind and refined it until it had taken on all the earmarks of a great gun battle, during which the boy had fought his way clear, but Stavrod and Pangle had been captured and killed. And in this latest version, Stavrod's final tune had been of his own composition, and it arose out of the full knowledge of immediate death. Stavrod had titled it Fiddler's Farewell, and it was the saddest song that had ever been made, and had drawn tears from the eyes of all present, even his executioners. But the boy was not a musician, and could not reproduce the tune, not even to whistle it accurately, and so it was, unfortunately, lost forever. He had run all the way to tell the women the story, and they had, in appreciation, insisted he spend as many days eating and resting in the house as it took him to recover from the ague he had acquired on his desperate flight down the mountain. It was a strange and possibly fatal affliction, with few external marks. Inman had put a number of questions to the boy, but found he did not know who Monroe was, nor where he might be, and could offer no help in identifying Ada's female companion, other than that he thought her to be the fiddler's daughter. The boy had given the best directions he could, and Inman set out once more walking. Thus it was he found himself sleeping again on the ground. His mind was all tangled. He lay by the fire, and thoughts came and went, and he had no control over them. Inman was afraid he was falling apart at a bad time. Then he wondered when a good time might be. He couldn't think of one. He tried to force the raggedness from his breathing and make it come steady. The assumption he worked from was that mastery of his thoughts might follow mastery of his lungs. But he could not even make his chest rise and fall at his bidding, and so his breath and his mind went where they would in juddering fashion. He thought Ada might save him from his troubles and redeem him from the past 4 years, and that there would be time ahead for her to do it in. He suspected you could work yourself some good in calming your mind by thinking forward to what great pleasure it would be to hold your grandchild on your knee. But to believe such an event might actually happen required deep faith in right order. How would you go about getting it when it was in such short supply? A dark voice came in Inman's mind and said no matter how much you might yearn for it and pray for it, you would never get it. You could be too far ruined. fear and hate riddling out your core like heartworms. At such time, faith and hope were not to the point. You were ready for your hole in the ground. There were many preachers, the like of Vesey, who swore they could save the souls of the awfulest kinds of sinner. They offered salvation to killers and thieves and adulterers, and even those gnawed by despair. But Inman's dark voice figured such braggart claims to be lies. Those men could not even save their own selves from living bad lives. The false hope they offered was poisonous as any venom. All the resurrection any man might expect was Vesey's, to be dragged dead from the grave at rope's end. There was fact in what the dark voice said. You could become so lost in bitterness and anger that you could not find your way back. No map nor guidebook for such journey. One part of Inman knew that. But he knew, too, that there were footsteps in the snow, and that if he awoke one more day, he would follow them to wherever they led, as long as he could put one foot in front of the other. The fire began to die out, and he rolled the hot stones onto the ground and stretched out next to them and fell asleep. When the cold wakened him before dawn, he was curled around the bigger of them as if it were his sweetheart. At first light he set out, and to the eye there was not hardly a trail at all, just a felt vacancy that drew him forward. Were it not for tracing the tracks in the old snow, Inman could not have kept to the way. He had lost confidence in his sense of direction, since during the past months he had been lost in every kind of place where parallel fences did not hem him in from going wrong. The clouds lowered, then a little wind fell down slope, carrying on it snow too dry and fine to be called flakes. It came so hard one minute as to sting the cheeks, and then it stopped the next. Inman looked at the cup tracks, and they held the new snow like blown grit. He came to a black pool set round as a jar lid on the ground. Ice had rimmed it, and a lone drake rode the water at its center, and it did not care enough even to turn its head to look at Inman. It seemed to look at nothing. Inman reckoned the drake's world was constricting about it, and that it would float there until the ice clenched at the webbing of its feet. Then, flap as it might, it would be pulled down to death. Inman first thought to shoot it and change its fate, at least in minor detail. But if he did, he would have to go waiting to get it, for he abhorred killing an animal and not eating it. And if he got it, he would be left in a quandary over his fast. So he left the duck to struggle it out with its maker and went on. When the trail turned uphill, snow started falling again. This time it was real snow, in flakes like thistle down, falling slantwise so thick it made Inman dizzy with its movement. The tracks began fading off like twilight as the snow filled them. He walked fast, climbing to a ridge, and when the tracks started to disappear, he broke into a run. He ran and ran downhill through dark hemlocks. He watched the tracks fill and their edges blur. No matter how fast he ran, the footprints disappeared before him until they were faint, like scars from old wounds. Then, like watermarks through paper held to window light. Then the snow lay even all around, unmarked. The flakes still fell hard, and Inman could not even feel the way the trail went. But he ran on until finally he stopped in a place where the hemlock stood black around him and made a world undifferentiated, with no compass degree preferable to another, and with not a sound but snow falling on snow. And he reckoned if he lay down, it would cover him. And when it melted, it would wash the tears from his eyes, and in time, the eyes from his head, and the skin from his skull. Ada and Ruby slept until Stavrod began coughing wet, racking coughs. Ada had bedded down in her clothes, and she awoke with the odd sensation of breeches twisted about her legs. The hut was cold and dim, and the fire had burned down to a smolder. The light from outside was odd and upthrown and spoke of snow. Ruby went to Stavrod. He had a line of fresh blood running from his mouth corner to his collar. His eyes opened, but he did not appear to know her. She put her hand to his brow and looked at Ada and said, "He's burning up." Ruby went to the corners of the hut and pulled down spider webs until she had a ball of them in her hands. Then she dug through her pouch of roots and took out two and said, "Get some water, and I'll make up a fresh poultice to dab on that borehole in his chest." She went and threw wood on the coals and bent to blow up the fire. Ada gathered her hair and put on her hat to keep it up. She took the pot to the spring and dipped it full of water and took it to the horse. He drank it dry with a great sound of suction. She refilled the pot at the creek and started back. The snow fell hard out of a dull, low sky, and it whited her coat sleeve where she held out her arm carrying the pot. A wind blew up and flapped her collar against her face. When she had nearly reached the hut, something, a slight movement, drew her eye upslope toward where she had entered the village the afternoon before. There, picking their way through the snow, went a flock of wild turkeys, 10 or 12 of them, among the bare trees of the hillside. A big male, colored pale gray as a dove, led them. He would take a step or two and then stop and probe in the snow with his bill and then move on. When the turkeys walked uphill, they pitched forward, their backs nearly horizontal to the ground. Their walking looked effortful, like old men harnessed to loads with tump lines. They were slim-bodied birds, long, not at all configured like yard turkeys. Ada moved slowly until she had put the hut between herself and the birds. She went in and set the pot down by the fire. Stavrod lay quiet. His eyes were closed, and his face ashy yellow, the color of cold lard. Ruby rose from where she sat beside him and busied herself setting the water to boil and readying the herb roots. "There are turkeys on the hillside," Ada said to Ruby as she bent over her work, peeling and mincing the roots. Ruby looked up. "I could do to grease my chin with a turkey leg," she said. "That shotgun's charged, both barrels. Go kill us one." "I've never fired a gun," Ada said. "It's about as easy a thing as there is," Ruby said. "Pull back the hammers, point it, fit the bead in the notch, trip either trigger, and don't shut your eyes when you do it. If you miss, pull the other trigger. Clamp the gun butt hard to your shoulder, or it might break your collarbone when it kicks. Move slow, for wild turkeys have the gift to disappear on you. If you can't get at least 20 steps near to them, don't waste a load." Ruby began mashing the root pieces against a stone with the flat of the knife blade, but Ada did not move, and Ruby looked up again. She saw the uncertainty on Ada's face. Ruby said, "Quit puzzling over it. The worst you can do is fail to kill a turkey, and there's not a hunter in the world hasn't done that. Go on." Ada climbed the slope with great care and deliberation. She could see the turkeys moving through the stand of chestnuts ahead of her and above her. They walked in the direction the falling snow was slanting on the wind. They were traversing the slope and seemed in no hurry. When the gray male found something to eat, they would bunch up and pick at it on the ground and then move ahead. Ada knew Ruby to be wrong in saying the worst one could do was miss. Everyone in the community had heard the story of the war widow from down the river. The winter previous, the woman had climbed a tree into a deer stand and had dropped her gun, and it discharged when it hit the ground so that, in effect, she shot herself out of the tree. She was lucky to have lived to be ridiculed for it. The woman had broken a leg in the fall and never walked straight thereafter, and she had 2 buckshot scars in her cheek like pox marks. Thinking such worrying thoughts of poor huntsmanship and its consequences, Ada made troubled progress up the slope. The shotgun felt long and misbalanced before her and seemed to quiver in her hands. She tried to circle around into the turkey's path and wait for them, but they shifted directions and went more directly up. She followed them for some time, climbing when they climbed and stopping when they stopped. As she walked, she tried to be quiet and still in her movements. She set each foot down slowly, letting the snow muffle her steps, and she was glad she wore breeches, for trying to be stealthy in long skirts and their underlying petticoats would be impossible, like walking through the woods flapping a bed quilt around. Even with all her care, Ada feared that the birds would do as Ruby claimed and vanish. She did not take her eyes off them and was patient, and eventually she closed to about the distance Ruby had specified. The turkeys stopped and swiveled their heads to look around. She stood still, and they did not see her. They pecked in the snow for food. Ada guessed that was about as clear a shot as she was likely to get, so she raised the gun slowly and sighted on the trailing birds. She fired, and to her amazement, a pair fell. The others took off flying low in a turmoil, and in their fright they flew downhill right at her. For a second, 200 pounds of birds tore through the air above her head. They went to cover in a laurel brake, and Ada stood and remembered to breathe. She thought back and could find no memory of a kick, though her shoulder felt numb. She did know, even though she had never used a firearm of any type in her life and had just the one discharge to tell her, that the shotgun's action was vague, that the trigger pull was long and had a crackle to it, and that it was a matter of some uncertainty where along its travel you would find the point of tension and release. She looked down at the scrollwork of the gun, the motif of vines and leaves, and the elaborate hammers which carried out that theme. She let the second one down slowly, from where it stood at alert. When Ada reached the fallen birds, she found a hen and a young cock. Their feathers had the hue and glint of metal, and one scaly gray foot of the hen was still clenching and unclenching in the snow. Inman heard a shot, at no great distance from where he stood. He pulled back the main hammer of the Lamats to full cock and went forward. He came out from under the dense hemlock shade into a chestnut grove, which sloped off toward a bold creek tumbling somewhere below. The light was low and grainy, and snow was falling in the chestnuts and had frosted their limbs. He walked down into them, and there was a gap in the way they grew, so that the black trunks stood rowed on either side, and the white fringe of limbs met overhead to shape a tunnel. Underneath was the suggestion of a lane, though no road had ever run there. The snow blew hard and smeared details. Though Inman could see clearly but three trees ahead through the blur, it seemed that at the end of the lane was a vague circle of light, fringed around with snowy limbs. He held the pistol loose in his hand, its muzzles aimed nowhere in particular other than forward. His finger made contact with the trigger, so that all the metal parts linking it with the hammer touched and tightened like a spark running through from one to the other. He walked ahead, and soon a figure bloomed out of the light before him, a black silhouette arched over by tree limbs. It stood straddle-legged at the end of the chestnut tunnel, and when it saw him, it brought to bear on him a long gun. The place was so quiet Inman could hear the click of metal as a hammer was thumbed back. A hunter, Inman guessed. He called out, saying, "I'm lost, and besides, we don't know enough about one another to start killing one another yet." He stepped forward slowly. First he could see the turkeys laid each by each on the ground. Then he saw Ada's fine face atop some strange, trousered figure like a mannish boy. "Ada Monroe," Inman said. "Ada." She did not answer him, but just looked at him. He was to the point that he figured, based upon experience, that his senses were not a thing to put much stock in. He believed his thought life might have gone astray, so that it had no more direction to it than a litter of blind puppies in a box lid. What he saw might be some trick of light working on a disordered mind. Bad spirits come upon him in form to befuddle. People saw things in the woods, even those with full bellies and steady minds. Lights moving where no lights could be. The forms of those long dead walking through the trees and speaking words in lost voices. Trickster spirits, in the shape of your deepest desire, leading you on and on to die mazed in some laurel hell. Inman racked back the little secondary shot-shell hammer of the Lamats. Ada, hearing her name spoken, was confused. She let the muzzles to the shotgun droop some inches from where they had been aimed at his chest. She examined him and did not know him. He appeared to be a beggar in cast-off clothes, rags thrown over a rood of sticks. His face was drawn and hollow-cheeked above the stubbled beard, and he stared at her out of strange black eyes shining deep in their sockets under the shadow of his hat-brim. They stood wary, about the number of paces apart specified for duelists, not clasping heart-to-heart as Inman had imagined, but armed against each other, weapons glinting hard light into the space between them. Inman studied Ada for trickery from within himself or from the spirit world. Her face was firmer than he remembered, harder. But the more he saw, the more he believed it to be truly her, despite the unlooked-for costume. So, having in the past taken up arms thoughtless to the consequences, he decided now to put them away the same. He let down his hammer and brushed back his jacket and stuck the pistol under his belt. He looked her in the eyes and knew it was her, and was overcome by love like a ringing in his soul. He did not know what to say, and so he said what his dream in the gypsy camp had told him. "I've been coming to you on a hard road, and I'm not letting you go." But something in him would not let him step forward to embrace her. It was not only the shotgun keeping him back. Dying was not the point. He could not step forward. He held out his empty hands, palms up at his sides. Ada still did not know him. He seemed to her some madman, a wanderer in the storm, knapsack on his back, snow in his beard and on his hat brim, speaking wild and tender words to whatever appeared before him, rock and tree and rill. Likely as not to cut somebody's throat would be Ruby's estimation. Ada raised the shotgun again, so it would break him open if she but pulled the trigger. "I do not know you," she said. Inman heard the word.